Well, welcome to the last in this series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of risk. For the real dedicated attendees, you'll recall that we've had people discussing how risk is measured, how it's perceived, and how it's manipulated and managed in the modern world, and how it was perceived very differently in the ancient world. And we've dealt with the risk of malicious terrorism, and we've dealt with the risk of natural disaster. And so it's appropriate that we end with the risk of disaster occurring through our own unmalicious behaviour. The titles Risk and Human-Induced Climate Change. Our speaker is Professor Bob Watson, who's a Professor of Environmental Sciences at University of East Anglia. He was trained at Queen Mary College London as a chemist and then did his doctorate there in atmospheric chemistry. He went on to do a number of things, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which always sounds very glamorous, and NASA, which sounds even more glamorous. But he spent many years as advisor to the American government and then to the World Bank. But now he's back in Britain, and he's the chief scientific advisor to the British Department of the Environment. As such, of course, he faces the massive challenge of assessing and advising on what's probably the greatest threat facing our planet. In dealing with it, he has the added risks that come unavoidably with this very politically and economically highly charged subject, risks which are currently vividly being illustrated by the controversy around environmental work at his own University of UEA. One can but sympathise. It's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Bob Watson.
Well, first, let me say it's a real pleasure to be here and an honour to be asked to give one of these lectures. And so what I do want to talk about is indeed climate change and the risk of climate change. So first I'll talk about the climate system, then I'll go, what are the implications of climate change? What are the risks do we face if we don't deal with climate change? Then I'll talk about how we can potentially address climate change. The first thing to point out is that climate change is often viewed as an environmental issue. Well, it is. But even more important, it's a development and a security issue. If we allow climate change to continue, we risk undermining food, water, and human security, and I'll talk about that more. We risk undermining our economy, the loss of natural capital. We risk undermining poverty alleviation and the livelihoods of the poor. Human health. It actually undermines the way we're trying to deal with biodiversity and ecosystems and their degradation. And it potentially, and I do want to stress potentially, leads to a risk of personal, national, and regional security. And I'll talk about that a little bit. Now, climate change is both an inter and intra-generational equity issue. It's the industrialized world that primarily caused the problem, but it's developing countries and poor people in developing countries that are most at risk. And if we don't deal with climate change now, its future generations will be at the greatest risk. So clearly, this is an issue we need to deal about. Now, we often think of climate change as a single environmental issue, but it's not. It's actually connected to all the other key environmental issues that are facing us at the national level, the regional level, and the global level. It effectively, climate change affects stratospheric ozone depletion. That's the ozone layer that actually protects us from harmful ultraviolet radiation, which, if it decreases, leads to more ultraviolet radiation at the Earth's surface and potential skin cancer, especially in light-skinned people. It affects biodiversity at the genetic, species, and ecosystem level. It affects the way our forests grow. It affects water resources, and I'll touch upon that. It affects aridification and desertification, goes hand in hand with other land management practices that are leading to desertification, especially in the arid lands and semi-arid lands in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. And it affects air pollution. So climate change is linked to all these other issues. But equally, these other issues affect climate change. If we change stratospheric ozone depletion due to the way we put certain chemicals into the atmosphere, we change the radiation balance of the upper atmosphere, it affects the lower atmosphere. When we change biodiversity, we change biogeochemical cycling, which affects the Earth's climate. When we effectively affect desertification, we change the albedo of the land, the reflectivity of the land, which again affects that climate change. So what we have to realise is we cannot think of climate change in isolation of all of these other environmental issues. Equally, we can't think of the other environmental issues separate from climate change. So what's happened to date? There's absolutely no question we humans have changed the atmosphere of our planet. We've put more carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. And these are greenhouse gases, and they tend to warm the atmosphere. We've also put more sulfur into the atmosphere. The sulfur gets converted into little particles, sulfate aerosols, and they tend to cool the atmosphere. So in two different ways, we've changed the atmospheric composition, and in turn, there are counteracting forces on how the Earth's climate will respond. But overall, what we've found is we're seeing warmer temperatures. We're seeing changes in precipitation patterns. The dry areas are getting drier, the wet areas are getting wetter. More precipitation is falling in heavy events. We saw that in Cockermouth in northern England only a few months ago. Less rainfall in light precipitation. And so what we actually see in one part of the world, you could have both more floods and more droughts in a given year in the same location. We're seeing higher sea level and storm surges. We're seeing most mountain glaciers around the world retreating, except for some of the polar glaciers. The Greenland ice cap's melting. The Arctic ice sheet is melting. We're seeing more extreme weather events, and we're seeing more intense cyclonic events. There is no doubt the Earth's climate is changing, and it's predicted to change even more in the future. If you look at this graph, what you tend to see here is all of the red bars, which you can see, are the temperatures of individual years from 1990 to 2007. The orange were individual years 1970 to 1989, a couple there, and there. The yellow is the 1950 to 1969, they're back here. And green, 1930 to 1949. What you easily see is all of the hot years are the years between 1990 and 2007. There is absolutely no doubt the last two decades have been the warmest decade of the last 150 years. And actually the last decade was the warmest decade of all. So there's no doubt surface temperature is increasing, not just over land, but over the oceans. Sea surface temperature itself is also changing. So there's absolutely no doubt the Earth's temperature is warming. If we now look at how do we simulate it, can we explain the warming? The black line are the observed temperatures for the last 100 years. So globally, the temperature only over land, the temperature over the ocean, the temperature over South America, North America, Europe, etc. The blue line, in each case, is a simulation with a sophisticated climate model where you only assume natural phenomena change. The output of the sun or changes in volcanic activity. Don't know what I did there, fine. And as you can see, really making a mess of this, aren't I? As you can see, the blue line does not simulate the black line either globally or regionally. If we now try a climate model that has all of human activity in it as well as changes in natural phenomena, increases in greenhouse gases, increases in aerosols, now what you see is the orange-pink line, and you can see a very good simulation, both globally and regionally. And it was this type of simulation, amongst others, that led the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to conclude in its fourth assessment report, it is very likely, greater than 90% probability, the observed warming since the Second World War is predominantly due to human activity. When you take into account we've also seen changes in sea level, melting of mountain glaciers, there is a self-consistent story that we humans are affecting the Earth's climate. Now the question, though, is what could happen in the future? Well, we don't know what the emissions of greenhouse gases into the future are. Why? It depends on the number of people in the Earth, demographic change. It depends on how the economy grows, weak or strong, demand for more or less energy. It depends on the technologies we use to produce the energy. It depends on whether the governments of the world work together for a sustainable world or not. And it depends on individual behavior. Will you and I become energy efficient? Will we drive large cars? Will we drive small cars? Will we turn the lights off in our houses or not? So there's many factors that go into how will greenhouse gas emissions change in the future. So we have what we call a low emissions scenario, a medium emissions, and a high emissions. So what you see over here is a lot of lines. These are different climate models trying to project global mean surface temperature out over time, basically. So this is for the 2020s, and in red, 2090s. What you can see is, of course, as you go out in time, the projected change in climate is more and more, and you see there's some spread or uncertainty in the models. But fundamentally, you can see that if we have a high emission scenario, we're likely to see a world 3.5 to 4 degrees warmer than it is today. But that's no good. We need to understand how will it change locally. So we've now got global maps. This is the map for the 2020s. This is the map for the 2090s. Now, the interesting thing about the 2020s, to a first approximation, that map is identical, whether you're in the low, medium, or high emission scenario. Why? The climate of the Earth for the next 20 to 30 years is governed by what we've already done. When we put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, gases like carbon dioxide, they live for 100 years. So the climate of the 2020s and also the 2030s is largely preordained. We've already set in motion further changes in the Earth's climate on what we've done already. But by the 2090s, there's a distinct difference. As you go from the low to the high emission scenario, the map gets hotter and hotter, redder and redder. The land areas warm more than the oceans, depending on the degree of redness, and the high latitudes warm more than the equatorial region. Most of you have probably heard about a Copenhagen meeting last year in December. It tried to get all the governments of the world together to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to reduce the risk of a large change in climate, and they failed miserably. As a scientist, I would say it was a catastrophic failure. As a member of the UK government, I would say it was a minor step in the right direction. That way I can keep my scientific colleagues happy and my bosses that are ministers. And it's also the truth. And so what we have to do is avoid the risk of this high emission scenario. What would happen in England? Let's come closer to home. This is the medium emission scenario that you saw on the last one. So we projected out to 2080, yes, a long way in the future. And this is our central estimate. And as you can see, our central estimate suggests most of England would be 4 to 5 degrees warmer, but some of the southwest, 5 to 6. But we looked at all of the uncertainties in the models. These models have got a lot of very complex physics, chemistry, even biology. And so there's a 10% chance, the Earth, the Great Britain will only warm this much. In other words, most of it, 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, South England, 2 to 3. Now remember, 2 to 3, that's only a 10% chance it will be this little. There's a 10% chance that it'll be as high as this. 8 to 9 degrees Celsius, even 10 degrees Celsius down in Devon and Cornwall. A very, very major change. If you remember 2003, the last time England had a summer, between 30,000 and 50,000 people unfortunately died in Europe. About 2,000 people died prematurely in England. That was the year 2003. It was a very, very hot summer. It was only 2 degrees warmer relative to the average. And so when you effectively say, we could be lucky and only see a 2 to 3 degrees warmer, that's the equivalent of the 2003 heat wave where thousands of people across Europe died. I'd hate to imagine what would happen to heat stress mortality in a world in England of 8, 9 and 10 degrees warmer. What will happen to precipitation? Probably as or more important than temperature. This is a global map, much harder to predict than temperature, far more uncertainty. This is December, January, February, June, July, August. The typical picture is blue is wetter, the high latitudes in both hemispheres, in both seasons, and throughout some of the tropics gets wetter. The arid and semi-arid areas in the subtropics of both hemispheres gets drier. And in particular, if you look here, what you can see is all of southern Europe gets much, much drier in June, July, and August. So if we look a little bit closer at Great Britain, this effectively is the annual number, averaged over the complete year. This is winter and this is summer. This is our 50% probability. And the yellow is there could be 10% less precipitation, so 10% less in Scotland. The very, very light blue, potentially 10% more in southern England. So not much change. Although it will, there will be more heavy precipitation events and less light. If I look at winter, however, the 50-50 probability, what I now see is typically 10 to 30% more precipitation in winter. But if I go to summer, typically 30 to 50% less precipitation in summer, much drier. What if we're unlucky at the 10% level? What happens if we get that 8, 9, 10 degree Celsius world? Well, what we'd have is a much wetter winter, as much as 30 to 50% more rainfall, but in summer, 50 to 70% less precipitation. So we could have summers 8 and 9 degrees warmer and 50, 60, 70% less precipitation. Good for sunbathing, terrible for water resource management, terrible for agriculture. So what are the impacts? Well, overall, there are some positive effects, but not many. Most are very negative. Decreased agricultural productivity for almost any warming throughout the tropics and subtropics. That's where we have hunger and famine today. Adverse effects on fishery. So potential adverse effects on food security. For a small amount of warming, it'll be good for England and Scotland and Wales. A longer thermal growing season, an earlier spring, a later winter, we can grow more crops. But once we get above about 2 degrees Celsius, it would probably be negative for the UK, and we'll have to think about what crops should we plant and how do we manage our water. Decreased water availability and water quality in many arid and semi-arid areas. Increased risks of floods, especially in developing countries, but potentially also in the UK. Therefore, an issue of water security. Adverse effects on ecological systems, especially coral reefs. We exacerbate the loss of biodiversity, as I've already said, the genetic and species level. Increased incidence of vector and waterborne diseases, malaria, dengue, and then cholera. Heat stress mortality. Threats to nutrition in developing countries, because of what I've already set up here, and threats of death due to increased severe weather events, floods, windstorms, etc., and adverse effects on human settlements due to flooding in riverine systems, look at Cockermouth, and also coastal erosion, something like Haysborough on the Norfolk coast. Haysborough will eventually fall into the sea if we don't have coastal protection. It's already the cliffs in East Anglia have been heavily, heavily eroded. So these are the basic risks if we don't try to get to grips with climate change. So on food security, running through some of them one at a time. Major successes at one level. Total amount of food relative to 1960 globally has gone up by almost 300%. Wonderful. Food amount per capita has gone up by about 40%. In other words, we've kept pace with population increase, so we have more food available today than we did per person than 1950. Food price, really not doing well on this button, am I? Food price, all-time low, especially relative to the 1970s, although in the last year or two, there was a sudden peak of increasing by a factor of two, and I'll come back to that. But overall, it looks like a good picture, but boy, we still have 1 billion people, 15% of the world's population, still go to bed hungry every day. And hunger has actually increased in SSA, sub-Saharan Africa, And it's not because we can't produce food. We can produce plenty. But poverty and bad trade systems mean institutional and policy means people are going hungry today throughout the developing world. Also, this increased production has come at an environmental cost. Increased greenhouse gas emissions affecting climate change, increased the loss of biodiversity because we've cut down our grasslands and we cut down our forests. We've got land and water degradation. So a major success at one level and a major failure at another level. And so we did have an increase in food prices in the last 2 years. Why? Poor harvests, especially in Australia and the USA, possibly linked to human-induced climate change, can't prove it. Increased use of biofuels. We use sugar for bioethanol, maize for bioethanol. So we've got competition of using food for both feeding people as well as producing energy. So the cost of food went up due to the competition. Increased demand, especially for meat in China as it's become wealthier. High energy prices, hence high fertilizer price. Speculation on the commodity market, an export ban in some large exporting countries to protect their domestic consumer. So was it just a blip of 1 or 2 years ago? No, every one of those issues is an issue we have to look at this year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 20 years. We have to manage climate change. We have to manage our use of biofuels. We have to manage and recognize there's an increased demand for meat. Energy prices will go up once this recession is over. What to what level, we don't know, but it will certainly increase. So our challenge is, how do we double food availability in the next 25 to 50 years, primarily in developing countries? How do we improve the type and the nutritional quality when we've got these sorts of challenges? And we must improve the ability of the agricultural sector, because the agricultural sector in a poor developing country both enhances rural livelihoods, it stimulates economic growth in a developing country, but we have to do it while meeting food safety standards. And climate change poses a major risk amongst other risks for this. We've also got to do it potentially with less labour. Why? Increasing levels of disease in sub-Saharan Africa, rural to urban migration. People don't want to work in the countryside. Less water available for agriculture. 75% of all water today, fresh water, is used for agriculture. There'll be more competition from other sectors. Less arable land, competition from roads, villages, cities, and energy crops. High energy prices, horribly distorted trade policies in OECD, not so much in Europe anymore, but still in the US. Land policy conflicts, loss of biodiversity, increased levels of air and water pollution, again, primarily in developing countries, and a changing climate. So we've got to double food availability at the very time we've got all of these challenges. I'm going to show you some maps that have been done by IFPRI, which is one of what we call a consultative group of international agricultural research centers. It's in Washington, D.C., does a lot of modeling of how will climate change affect agricultural production. And all this really shows you is if you're in red and yellow here, it means, and this is rain-fed rice, any of the little dots of red and yellow is where we lose rice productivity. If we see the blue, it's where we gain. So we gain there, we lose here. We gain in some of these areas, we lose in some. Don't need to look at the detail. All this shows you a very, very sophisticated map of the world with high spatial resolution to look at what could happen to rice that's rain-fed. They've also done it, let me go back. So they did it first for irrigated rice, then they did it for rain-fed rice, then they integrated it. So what you see here is, this is rice production in South Asia today, light blue. This is what we think would happen to rice production by 2050 without climate change, so an increase in production. This is what we think will happen with climate change. So with climate change, we'll still have more production relative today, but far less production than we would have had without climate change. Same picture for East Asia, and they're the two main regions of the world on rice production. Not going to dwell upon it. Exactly the same thing has been done for irrigated wheat and rain-fed wheat. And what's the conclusion? Even more drastic. Wheat production today, wheat production in 2050 without climate change, almost a factor of two increase. But with climate change, almost increase over today. In fact, in East Asia, potentially even less than today, and in Europe, about the same. So again, climate change projected a major impact on our ability to grow wheat by 2050. They did the same thing for maize, again, not worth looking at the detail and the overall picture on maize. A little bit more positive, thank goodness. If you look at East Asia, that's it today. In 2050, if anything, climate change is a slight benefit for maize in East Asia and a slight benefit, maybe no benefit, in Latin America. The bottom line is not a good picture. Child malnutrition. 2000 is in yellow, so that's the number of children under five that are malnourished today. By 2050, we were hoping it would drop from about 80 million to about 50. It does drop, but with climate change, not so much. Same there. Sub-Saharan Africa is a major problem. It doesn't matter what we do, we think we're going to have problems in getting enough food for people in sub-Saharan Africa. So climate change will adversely affect, we project, our ability to reduce child malnutrition. If we look at available calories per capita, per person, and it's the same picture today, 2050, without climate change, with climate change, you can see there'll be less calories per person in South Asia, even relative to today, per person. Well, that is with a higher population. We've taken population into account. And so you can see the general picture that climate change will adversely affect calorific availability. And if you look at food price, we would have projected it went up for, say, rice, wheat, maize, from today to 2050, but with climate change, the projections are even more. In other words, climate change, unabated, will have a major impact on food availability and the price of food. So what about water security? Well, by 2025, more than half of the world's population will live in an area of severe water stress, even without climate change. Water quality is also declining in many parts of the world. 70%, as I've already said, of all fresh water is currently used for irrigation, and 15 to 35% is already unsustainable, We've lost many of the wetlands of the world already, 50 to 60. And the reason is, to some degree, we don't pay for water. In most parts of the world, it's viewed as a human right to have water. We don't charge for it, therefore we waste it. And so there's only 20% cost recovery of delivering water to the end user. And the key problem is human-induced climate change is projected to very adversely affect what is already a major challenge, even in the absence of human-induced climate change. So if you look at today, 1995, well, it's not today, but a decade ago, compared to 2025, the orange areas are where we had water withdrawal 40% relative to totally available. That is not sustainable. Yellow, 20 to 40. And as you can see, when you go from 1995 to 2025, there are far more water-stressed areas. The US becomes a water-stressed area. All of China becomes a water-stressed area. And far more of North Africa and all of India and Southeast Asia becomes water-stressed. And that's without climate change. If you actually then go forward, this just quickly shows you sub-Saharan Africa. This is the rainfall today. Less than 400 millimeters in red. 400 to 1,000 millimetres in yellow, more than 1,000 millimetres in green. Red areas are basically heavily arid and semi-arid. This shows you under very medium climate change scenario, red, a drop of at least 10 to 20% in rainfall. So the red area is getting drier. It's already dry, it's going to get even drier. The yellow areas are also going to get drier, only the wet areas get wetter. It's a general picture around the world. The wet areas get wetter, the dry areas get drier. And so what happens to runoff is a measure of, to a first approximation, a measure of the total amount of rainfall that falls and to some degree the way it evaporates. So it's a temperature precipitation measure. And what you fundamentally see here is nearly all of the food bowls of the world, American Midwest, Southern Europe, some parts of Southern Africa, all get drier, a major threat to both water resource management and to agricultural productivity. So biodiversity, the species, birds, butterflies, plants, microbes, fungi, they're affected for five reasons. Habitat change. You convert a forest to an agricultural system. You convert a grassland to an agricultural system. You convert a mangrove swamp into a farmland, a shrimp farm. Climate change. Invasive species. We bring species from abroad to grow them in England, or an animal, either accidentally or purposely, a major threat. Overexploitation. The world's fisheries is a good example, that we've overexploited our fisheries. They're no longer sustainable in about almost 75% of the world's oceans today. And pollution due to nitrogen, phosphorus, and I should have put sulfur as well. So in a study that I chaired, an international study of 1,400 scientists, we looked at forests, we looked at dry lands, we looked at coastal marine islands, we looked at mountains, polar regions. The colour, a dark red, means that that was a major driver for change in the last 50 to 100 years. So in other words, habitat change in red, major driver of changing tropical forests and temperate forests. We converted them into agriculture. We converted them into livestock pastures. A light yellow colour, like you see for most of climate, means it was not a real threat. Climate change was not a threat over the last 100 years for almost any system except for the polar region, and there it was a high threat, but not a very high threat. As you can see, overexploitation, a major issue for the marine environment. As I've said, much of our marine environment is overfished, and in pollution, for example, major adverse effects on, say, waterways. So the colour tells you how bad it was in the last 50 to 100 years. The arrow tells you what we, based on expert judgment and modelling, what could happen in the next 50 to 100 years. And if the arrow is vertically up, it means it will become an increasing and major driver of change in the next 100 years. And what you see is, in every habitat of the world, we believe climate change will be a major threat. And if we don't deal with airborne pollution, we will also see it as a major threat. Some of the other ones, if the arrow's going sideways, it means it stays about the same. And if it goes down, and there's not many going down, if any, it means it'll be less of a threat in the next 100 years. So we've tried to look at what's happened to our ecosystems in the last 100 years and what could happen in the future. And the key message is climate change wasn't a major threat, but it is about to become one. Why do we care about our ecosystems? Well, we obviously care the innate value. We like flowers, we like animals, birds, etc. But even more important, or as important, is they provide us our so-called provisioning services. Our ecosystems provide food, fresh water, fuel, wood. They regulate our climate. They regulate floods. They regulate disease. They regulate the water purification. They have cultural value, aesthetic, spiritual, educational, recreational, and they're supported by soil formation, nutrient cycling. So these actually link to the constituents of well-being. They link to the basic material for a good life, nutritious food, shelter. They link to human health, also feeling well. They link to social relationships. The Lake District, the Cotswolds, we enjoy going there. We feel spiritually alive versus being, say, in a slum in a major city. So these ecosystems have value that are spiritual as also providing our food. And so they're absolutely essential to providing sustainable development. Well, the problem is climate change and biodiversity are inextricably linked. Basically, climate change affects biodiversity at the genetic species and ecosystem level. But what hasn't been realized appropriately today, biodiversity can help us adapt to climate change, and biodiversity can help us to mitigate or to avoid climate change. And we need to bring the issues of climate change and biodiversity together. And so why does climate change affect, or how does it affect biodiversity? It affects the timing of the reproduction or the migration of birds, butterflies, other animals. It affects the length of the growing season. It affects species distribution and the number of species, population size. It's affected by pest and disease outbreaks, and especially coral reefs, affected by coral bleaching due to increasing temperature. And so climate change directly affects it through changes in temperature and precipitation and for marine systems, sea level. But indirectly, the intensity and frequency of wildfires and pests. So there's a strong effect of climate on our biodiversity. Who's most vulnerable? Well, the risk of extinction increases, especially those that have only got low population numbers, or in a very small patch, endemic species. So fundamentally, and those with very limited climatic range. If you're a flower that sits on top of a mountain and it gets hotter, the climatic zones go up, that flower has nowhere to go. If you're an alpine species or a polar species, then you've got nowhere to go if the Earth gets warmer. So the limited climatic range is absolutely critical, and I'll show you something. Systems that are incredibly sensitive, coral reefs, unbelievably sensitive to even small changes, 1 or 2 degrees Celsius in temperature. Mangroves, very, very sensitive. And as I've already said, the high latitude and high altitude systems. Some of the most rich ecological systems in the world are in southern Africa, the succulent Karoo, the Cape Floristic Kingdom. When you get climate change, the Earth warms up and species want to move poleward. They either want to move up in altitude, in mountains, or poleward. These species have nowhere to go. To move poleward, they're going to have to learn how to swim. Equally, the ones in Madagascar, the plants will have to learn how to swim. Southwest Australia, New Zealand. Many of our most rich biodiversity areas are in the southern areas of islands or continents and have got nowhere to go, which is why the species extinction is a very, very serious potential. Recently, we've come to understand, and we should have done it years ago, I don't know why we missed this as scientists, we made a mistake. As you put more CO2 into the atmosphere, more and more is absorbed by the oceans, and the oceans become more acidic. And we're now trying to understand what the implications of more acidic oceans are. But the view is it will have adverse effects on coral systems, shellfish, and even on other fisheries. So when we look at our seas today, our oceans, we have to say, what's the implication of a change in temperature? What's the implication of a change in acidification? What's the effect of a change in sea level? All of these will affect ocean life. And on top of that, you have to put land-based pollution and overfishing. Very, very nervous that the Earth's oceans are in dire straits. So what do we actually project? Well, what we've actually projected is an increasing number of ecosystems are likely to be disrupted by a temperature rise of more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. That for every 1 degree rise today, we're going to lose 10% of our species. So if we do see a 5 degree rise, the projection is 50% loss of species. How good that number is, I don't know. But whether it's 50% or 40% or 30%, even 20%, that's a major extinction of species. So even if we were wrong, that it's not 10% per 1 degree rise, that it was 5% or 3%, that would still, to me, be very serious. I've already said wet groves and mangroves, very, very sensitive. And therefore, without strong mitigation, limiting climate change, many, if not all, of cloud forests and coral reefs may cease to function, certainly within the next century, but possibly, for some of them, even the next few decades. Oops. The trouble is, who makes decisions? Mainly Treasury ministers. Of all ministers in government, other than the head of state, the most powerful is the man that controls the budget. And one of the reasons we're losing biodiversity is we haven't put value on biodiversity. We've valued the food that we grow, we've valued the timber, but we haven't valued that the ecosystems control the climate, or air quality, or water purification. There's no value in the marketplace. And so one of the reasons we're losing biodiversity is we don't value biodiversity. So something I'm co-chairing now with Steve Alban from Scotland with about 200 experts, social scientists, economists, natural scientists, can we put value on our ecosystem services so we can go to the minister in the Treasury Department and say, If we lose biodiversity, we're undermining the British economy and we're undermining the global economy. So we looked at some of these things that I've already mentioned: soil formation, water cycling, regulating climate, pollination services. These all help give you what we call our ecosystem services, final, water availability, trees, detoxification, purification of water. What we actually then finally get to are goods, what we actually use: food, drinking water, fiber, energy, medicines, pollution control, flood control, erosion control. So we've tried to break out how do we look at these ecosystem services, and then we've actually started to put a value on them. We've put an economic value, and we've also put a non-economic value. How do these services also help our human health, our happiness, our well-being? And so the study has just started. We're about a third of the way through it. But at the end of the day, we'll not only tell the politicians why these services are important, we will put both economic and non-economic value. So we've got to understand the measure of economic wealth of GDP, gross domestic product, is a fatally flawed one. It doesn't take into account the importance of natural capital, which is what this is. It doesn't take into account built capital appropriately, nor human capital, education or social capital. So we would argue that we should complement the economic measure of GDP, not replace it, but complement it with the four sources of wealth: built, human, social and natural capital. And this particular project for the UK will try and put a value on our natural capital. Pavan Sukhdev is doing an international global study called The Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity team, and he's trying to look at it at a global level. So we're going to try and convince ministers in Treasury departments that ecosystems are not only great to look at, they provide essential services and they have major economic value. So on human security, and I should try and go a bit quicker, sea level rise. I'm actually going quite slow. Sea level rise is a major threat to all of the deltaic areas like the Nile in Bangladesh, the Pearl River in China. And we also recognize there's lots of small island states, especially in the Pacific, the Maldives, Kiribati, Tuvalu. Their highest level is typically 1 meter above sea level. We're projecting in the next 100 years that we could see a 1 meter sea level rise, and in 200 years, almost certainly, a 1 meter sea level rise. So these very, very low island states, the deltaic areas in Bangladesh, in China, in Egypt, could displace potentially tens, if not more than 100 million people, a major issue for people living in low-lying areas. There's a major risk of conflict. Can't quantify it, I can't prove it, but just think through the logic. If I take sub-Saharan Africa, lots of poverty, lots of bad governance, lots of corruption. Not a great situation to start with. A lot of it: food insecurity, water insecurity, and energy insecurity. Climate change will exacerbate food shortage in Africa. It'll exacerbate water shortage in Africa. It will deplete natural resources that poor people depend upon. It will increase the incidence of disease and increase the incidence of severe weather. And in the coastal areas, in the low-lying areas, potentially displace millions of people. So we have a continent such as sub-Saharan Africa that's in poor shape today, and it will only get worse. And therefore, climate change, coupled with a wide range of other stresses, risks local and regional conflict and migration. It will depend on the social, economic, and political circumstances, but it's an issue we need to take care of. It could lead to conflict and therefore peacekeeping. It could lead to migration into Europe, into North America. So this is an issue that really has to be looked at very, very carefully. So how do we mitigate the risks? Well, first, who should decide what the risks are? Who should decide what dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system is? This is not for scientists. We can tell you what the risks are. We can't tell you what's acceptable. Therefore, it's a value judgment. It has to be determined through a socio-political process, but informed by scientific, technical, and socio-economic information. We have to understand what the physical or social outcomes are. Do we care about the danger for all of us or the most vulnerable individual? Who defines dangerous? So do we care about food security globally or locally? Water security globally or locally? Do we care about the most vulnerable from a human health or the average? So it has to be government decides based on public opinion. It is not up to us as scientists to make that decision. So the EU has decided that we should try and limit climate change to 2 degrees Celsius relative to pre-industrial. All this says is even by 2 degrees Celsius, we'll already be seeing some adverse effects on food, water, loss of ecosystems, increase in extreme weather event, and at 2 degrees, probably no real risk of an abrupt or an irreversible change. So the EU has said, let's try and mitigate and limit it to 2. I would argue it's an incredible stretch target. I would argue it's potentially very, very difficult to meet, although many politicians still believe it's plausible. It's plausible, but not likely, in my opinion. And therefore, I would argue we need to get ready to adapt to 4 degrees Celsius. So the issue is, what level of risk are we willing to bear? What are we willing to mitigate, and at what cost? Of course, Nick Stern said the cost of inaction greatly exceeds the cost of action. And that's what we need to. If we don't act, we will lose food supply in some parts of the world. We will adversely affect water. We will adversely affect human health. So if we want to limit it to, we can try and limit what we call carbon dioxide and all the other greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide equivalent, at 400 parts per million, or between 400 and 450. We've got a 50-50 shot of stabilizing at 2. If we go to 550 parts per million of CO2, we've got a 50-50 shot at 3. We go to 650, a 50-50 shot at 4. We're already close to 400 today, and it looks like CO2 and the other greenhouse gases are going to increase significantly relative to today, and that's why I say this is a great target, but I think we're more likely, if we're not careful, to be somewhere between 550 and 650, hence we need to try and think how to adapt to an even warmer world. What does this mean to hit, say, about 450, 500? Instead of OECD industrial emissions increasing by 60% between 2002 and 2050, we have to have an 80% reduction. So relative to today, we can only emit 20% of the emissions we emit today with a wealthier world, more people. In developing countries, instead of increasing at 140%, they could only increase at the very, very most 60%. So we need to drastically decarbonize our energy system in order to go to a low carbon economy to have any hope of even making a 500 part per million world. How do we do it? We need to put a price on carbon. We need to transform our technology. And we need to mobilize behavior change. It's not simple. We need technological change. We need to change the price of energy, and we need to change individual behavior. Well, how can we do it on technology? Well, we can have more efficient production of energy, and we can have more efficient use of energy, more efficient cars, fuel cell cars, smaller cars, use mass transportation, use the train. I don't own a car in England. I did in America, I have to be honest. But here I don't. I use the train and the bus, and occasionally rent a car. Better buildings, more efficient industries. Use more gas than coal, you get more, for the same energy, less carbon dioxide emissions. More renewable energy, wind power, solar power, solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, wave and tidal power, large scale and small scale hydropower and bioenergy. More renewable. If we do use fossil fuels, such as coal, to produce electricity, can we capture the carbon dioxide before it goes into the atmosphere, called carbon capture? And then can we store it in depleted oil wells, gas wells, etc.? Nuclear power, going to have to be part of the solution for most countries, and we need to manage our forests and agricultural soils. We need to do not one of these, but all of these. We need a portfolio of energy production and use and better management of our forests in order to go to a low-carbon economy. But we can use our ecosystems. We can protect our natural forests so we don't deforest and put carbon dioxide in there. We can actually have sustainable management. We can actually, where should it be? Yeah, we can reforest. We can grow trees where they used to grow, but we cut them down for agricultural land. We can manage our wetlands better. We can manage our agriculture better. Huge emissions from agriculture, from livestock, methane, from rice, methane, and also the way we use fertilizers put more nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. So there's lots of things we can do in our ecosystems to help us move to a low-carbon economy, but that only complements, it doesn't replace, being much more efficient both in our production and use of energy. Let me miss that one. It's a very complicated one. If we put a price on carbon, will it reduce emissions? So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said, what if we put a price on carbon, $20 a ton, $50 a ton, or $100? And they did lots of estimates. What would happen in energy supply, in our transport system, in our buildings, industry, agriculture, forestry, and waste? And in every sector, they found if you put a price on carbon, there was the potential to significantly reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide per year. It would stimulate you to go to a better technology that did not emit carbon. So in other words, if you put a price of $50 a ton on the production of electricity, rather than using coal, it now becomes economically viable to use wind power or solar power or tidal power. If you put a price on transportation, it allows you to go from a normal car to, say, a hybrid car. So putting a price on carbon allows you to force you towards clean technology. But we also need policies. We need to put, as I've already said, energy pricing. We need to remove subsidies. We subsidize directly or indirectly in many parts of the world fossil fuels. We don't price it correctly. We don't put the true price on fossil fuel because on coal, people die in the coal mine through explosions, black lung disease. When you get emissions of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere or black carbon, it comes at an economic cost, and it comes at a cost effectively on climate change. So we need to do two things. We need to reduce the subsidies, and we need to internalize the social costs of environmental degradation. And again, wind power, solar power, tidal power become more competitive. We need to, what we call emission permits. In different parts of the world, it costs a different amount of money to save carbon. China has an inefficient energy system. So does India. So do most countries in developing. So it's cheaper to avoid carbon emissions in most developing countries than it would be in a country with a sophisticated and efficient energy system. So what we want to do is buy and sell carbon just like you buy and sell rice in different parts of the world. In other words, for the same amount of money, we can reduce emissions more in China than you can in the USA or in England, and the atmosphere doesn't care where the emissions come from. So we've got a whole system called emission permit and trading. We should have regulatory programs, any energy efficient standards on cars, on buildings, on refrigerators, on computers. When you get a new technology, it's sometimes hard to get into the marketplace. So we need to give incentives to break down what we call market barriers. And we need to educate people to say, was the product a high carbon product or a low carbon product? In very much the same way we say, what's in food today? This is an interesting one. We polled many, many thousands of people in England and Scotland and asked them, do you have an ability to act, to go to low carbon? Do you have a willingness to act? Very interesting. There was almost seven co-equal cohorts, none less than 12%, no more than 18%. They all believed in climate change. It wasn't they were skeptics on climate. You had the positive greens. I want to be green. I want to go to low carbon, 18%. The concerned consumer also wanted to be green. All you had to tell with these people was give them information and they would act. You had some sideline supporters, you had the honestly disengaged. And so what you know here is these guys, give them information and they'll act. Some guys effectively who are sidelined, if you give them some incentives, it increases their ability to act. So some financial incentives for attic insulation, potentially other energy efficient products, you need to give them incentives. But the so-called honestly disengaged, I'm going to be rude for a second, I also call them I don't give a shit, because they don't. They're going to have a big car. They're going to go on as many vacations as they want. They're going to waste energy because they don't disagree with climate change. They don't care. These guys you can't get to with either incentives nor information. You have to have regulations. So the reason for doing this segmentation analysis was to understand the public of where would you only have to give information, where do you have to give financial incentives, and where do you have to have regulations. So what do we need to do? And I've got a few more slides, and I should just finish within the hour. We need a long-term, international, regulatory, legally binding framework with all emitters, not just the US, Europe, Japan and Russia, the industrialized world, but also China, India, and other developing countries. But we have to recognize 80% of the emissions in the atmosphere today are due to the industrialized countries, Europe, North America, and Russia. Therefore, the allocation has to be equitable. China and India cannot have the same responsibilities, in my opinion, as the US and Europe. Over time, maybe, but not today. But we need them on board, so we have to have an equitable allocation of responsibilities, and we need every 10 years targets leading up to 2030, 2050. We need to bring on board the United States, which are not on board today, and Obama will have a very difficult time getting a climate bill through the Senate, especially when he lost the supermajority and he lost the Senate seat in Massachusetts. And he's just had three very large companies who were supporting a climate bill in the Senate. Caterpillar, Phillips Conoco, and BP USA have now decided they will not support the bill. So for Obama to get a bill through the Senate is going to be very difficult this year, even though he is personally heavily committed. But if you don't bring the USA on board, there's not a hope of bringing China and India on board. So much of the politics revolves around what happens in the USA. But you have some states like California with Schwarzenegger, incredibly pro-climate. You also have states like New York, very pro-climate. But we need the US as a whole to embrace the challenge of climate change. Adaptation. Why are developing countries more vulnerable than developed countries? They're much closer to what we call the margin of tolerance. They're much more drought and flood prone. 49 of the 50 countries that are potentially going to be hit with sea level rise are developing countries. A larger share of their economy is susceptible and vulnerable to climate change, i.e., there's a lot in agriculture. You know, the US, the UK, only 2 or 3% of our GDP is in agriculture, although about a significant amount is upon along the whole food supply chain in the UK. But a large part of the economy of most sub-Saharan African countries is in agriculture that's very climate sensitive. And effectively, they're already much poorer on nutrition and health. So any change in the nutritional status is really very, very negative for them. How do you get to address climate change and adaptation? Well, you need good technology, not very available in a developing country. You need institutional capacity, legal frameworks, good governance, missing in a lot of African and other developing countries. You need knowledge and know-how and education. Again, less in developing countries. And even most important of all, you need the financial capacity. So developing countries, even with the same threat as us, have limited ability due to a lack of technology, institutional capacity, education, and finance. So to adapt, it's a risk management. You need a financing, you need good information, you need education, you need legislation. But fundamentally, to deliver adaptive responses, you need good governance. You need adaptive capacity and self-organization. It's determined by governance. Cost and benefit is determined by governance. At the end of the day, if you don't have good governance, you can't deal with climate change, either to mitigate, avoid it, or to adapt. Again, ecosystems, especially in developing countries, can really help. Mangrove systems and coral reefs stop coastal erosion. So we want to maintain our coral reefs, maintain our mangroves. If we manage our upland wetlands and floodplains, it helps on water flow and quality. So we need the floodplains, and we can't keep building on them. We need to conserve and restore our forests. It regulates our water flow. The Chinese totally deforested the Yangtze Basin. They've got the same amount of precipitation today as they had 30 years ago, but they deforested the Yangtze Basin. Almost every year they get major, major floods displacing people. They don't have the forested system to hold the water, so they get flash floods. Agroforestry systems, where you combine trees and crops, actually help you with the risk of climatic change. So major ways we can use our ecosystems, just about finished. So on agriculture, we need to address the water deficit problem, drought-tolerant crops, better irrigation, more temperature-tolerant crops. We need crops that are more resistant to pests and disease. We've got to maintain our soil fertility, decrease salinization of soil. We've got to become less energy intensive. We've got to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to improve nutritional quality. All of these things are going to be needed to adapt our agricultural system to climate change. But there's a fundamental problem. We can't just adapt. There are physical limits to adaptation. The Cayman Islands disappear with a sea level rise of 1 meter. Behavioral limits. We use New Orleans as an example with Hurricane Katrina. People also aren't willing to adapt. The system isn't ready to adapt. Society isn't all ready to adapt. And there are technological limits. Holland, the UK, we will protect ourselves in large measure against sea level rise. The Thames Barrier will just make it higher. We can protect ourselves in London against sea level rise. I can't imagine this in Bangladesh or in many poor developing countries. They can't afford the technology. So we need a long-term goal. We need strong targets, which I've already said, in developed countries. We need to bring developing countries on board. We need to buy and sell carbon as a commodity. We need better technology. We need to adapt as well as to mitigate. We need to manage our lands and therefore stop deforestation that loses biodiversity and also puts carbon into the atmosphere. And we've got to think, what do we do on aviation and marine? And these are real, real challenges, and we haven't solved that one. So in conclusion, we need a legally binding, long-term, equitable, keyword, agreement to reduce the risk of climate change. There's absolutely no dichotomy between reducing the threat of climate change and economic growth. If we do not act, we will have social and economic disruption, so the cost of inaction exceeds the cost of action, as Nick Stern said. There certainly are, in my opinion, cost-effective and equitable solutions to address climate change and biodiversity loss, but we need political will, we need moral leadership, and we need substantive changes in our energy policies, our practices, and our technologies, and currently they're not underway. We've started a journey, but we're nowhere near where we need to be. We need both public and private sector decision makers to take a much longer term perspective, and advances in science and technology are required. Thank you.
Well, that's something to tell our grandchildren, isn't it? How much we've mucked up their planet. And what I find particularly chastening is that how recently the damage has been done, mostly within the course of my own adult life. Professor Watson has given us a fascinating and authoritative account of the challenge posed by planetary warming to life and to its diversity. He's talked about the social problems that will accumulate, and he's talked of the political challenge when the causes are so remote and that the causes are so elusive to price. It's going to require global action, and it's going to require behavioral change comparable to that undergone by civil populations in times of war. And yet there's this grim paradox that the most affected countries are the poorest and the ones that have the least influence on the underlying problem. For a magisterial review of this quite unprecedented problem, thank you very much indeed. Can I just say a word of thanks for the series, organised by Michael Scott, Leila Skins and Tony Cox. I found it fascinating, and I'm sure many other people here have as well. Very much indebted to Richard and Anne King for funding it. It's so nice not to have commercial strings attached to something that we can make just intellectually interesting. And thanks to all the many Darwinians who make the whole thing work. It's a great thing for the college. But there's next year. There's next year. And if I get my magic wand, I can go... Don't blame me. So, next year we move from risk to beauty. It may be a bit jollier. Thank you very much.